6. I liked Enid Lacey. I had already spent a couple of hours in the bookstore. She certainly knew how to sell books. She had read almost every book about Central Australia and tried to stock every title in print. In the room, which served as an art gallery, she had 2 easy chairs for customers. "Read as much as you like," she'd say, "no obligation," knowing damn well, of course, that once you sat in that chair, you couldn't go away without buying. She was an old Territorian in her late 60s. Her nose and chin were excessively pointed. Her hair was auburn from the bottle. She wore 2 pairs of spectacles on chains and a pair of opal bracelets around her sun-withered wrists. "Opals," she said to me, "have brought me nothing but luck." Her father had been manager of a cattle station near Tennant Creek. She had lived with Aboriginals all her life. She would stand for no nonsense, and secretly adored them. She had known all the older generation of Australian anthropologists, and didn't think much of the new ones, the jargon-mongers, as she called them. The truth was that, though she tried to keep abreast of the latest theories, though she battled with the books of Levi Strauss, she never made much headway. For all that, when Aboriginal affairs were up for discussion, she would assume her best pontifical manner, changing pronouns from I to we, not the royal we, but we, meaning the body of scientific opinion. She had been among the first to see the merit of Pintupi painting. Being a shrewd businesswoman, she knew when to give credit to an artist, when to withhold it, and to refuse payment altogether if the artist seemed set on a blinder. So when if one of her boys turned up, doddery on his feet at closing time, which at the Fraser Arms was opening time, she'd click her tongue and say, "Dearie me, I can't find the key to the cash box. You'll have to come back in the morning." And when next morning the artist came back, grateful not to have drunk away his earnings, she'd waggle her finger grimly and say, "You're going home now, aren't you?" "Yes, ma'am," he'd say, and she'd add a little extra for the wife and kids. Mrs. Lacey paid far less for paintings than galleries in Sydney or Melbourne, but then she charged far less for paintings, and the paintings always sold. Sometimes a white welfare worker would accuse her of ripping off the artists. But money from Sydney or Melbourne had a way of getting siphoned off into Aboriginal cooperatives, whereas Mrs. Lacey paid cash on the nail. Her boys knew a deal when they saw one and kept coming back to the bookstore. We followed Stan inside.
"You're late, silly."
Mrs. Lacey adjusted her spectacles. He was edging towards her desk between 2 customers and the bookshelf.
"I said to come Tuesday," she said. "I had the man in from Adelaide yesterday. Now we'll have to wait another month."
The customers were a couple of American tourists who were deciding which of 2 colour plate books to buy. The man had a tanned and freckled face and wore blue Bermudas and a yellow sports shirt. The woman was blonde, nice-looking but a little drawn, and dressed in a red batik smock printed with Aboriginal motifs. The books were Australian Dreaming and Tables of the Dreamtime. Old Stan laid the package on Mrs. Lacey's desk. His head swayed to and fro as he muttered some excuse. His musty smell filled the room.
"Idiot!" Mrs. Lacey raised the pitch of her voice. "I've told you 1,000 times. The man from Adelaide doesn't want Gideon's paintings. He wants yours."
Arcady and I kept our distance at the back, by the shelves of Aboriginal studies. The Americans had perked up and were listening.
"I know there's no accounting for taste," Mrs. Lacey continued. "He says you're the best painter at Popinjee. He's a big collector. He should know."
"Is that so?" asked the American man.
"It is," said Mrs. Lacey. "I can sell anything Mr. Jacamara sets his hand to."
"Could we see?" asked the American woman, "please."
"I couldn't say," Mrs. Lacey replied. "You'll have to ask the artist."
"Could we?"
"Can they?"
Stan trembled, hunched his shoulders, and covered his face with his hands.
"You can," said Mrs. Lacey, smiling sweetly and snipping at the plastic with her scissors.
Stan withdrew the fingers from his face and, taking hold of one edge of the canvas, helped Mrs. Lacey unroll it. The painting was about 4 foot by 3 and had a background of pointillist dots in varying shades of ochre. In the centre there was a big blue circle with several smaller circles scattered around it. Each circle had a scarlet rim around the perimeter, and connecting them was a maze of wiggly flamingo-pink lines that looked a bit like intestines. Mrs. Lacey switched to her second pair of glasses and said, "What you got here, Stan?"
"Honey ant," he whispered in a hoarse voice.
"A honey ant," she turned to the Americans, "is one of the totems at Popinjee. This painting's a honey ant dreaming."
"I think it's beautiful," said the American woman thoughtfully.
"Like it's an ordinary ant?" asked the American man. "Like a termite ant?"
"No, no," said Mrs. Lacey. "A honey ant's something very special. Honey ants feed on mulga sap. Mulga, that's a tree we have here in the desert. The ants grow honey sacs on their ear ends. They look like clear plastic bubbles."
"Is that so?"
the man said. "I've eaten them," said Mrs. Lacey. "Delicious."
"Yes," sighed the American woman. She had fixed her gaze on the painting. "In its own way, it is truly beautiful."
"But I can't see any ants in this painting," the man said. "You mean it's like it's a painting of an ant's nest? Like those pink tubes or passages?"
"No," Mrs. Lacey looked a little discouraged. "The painting shows the journey of the honey ant ancestor."
"Like it's a route map," he grinned. "Yeah, I thought it looked like a route map."
"Exactly," said Mrs. Lacey.
The American wife, meanwhile, was opening and closing her eyes to see what impression the painting would make on her when, finally, she kept them open.
"Beautiful," she repeated.
"Now, sir,"
the man addressed himself to Stan,
"do you eat these honey ants yourself?"
Stan nodded.
"No, no," the wife shrilled. "I told you this morning. You do not eat your own totem. You could be killed for eating your ancestor."
"Dearest, this gentleman says he does eat honey ants. Is that correct, sir?"
Stan continued to nod.
"I'm confused," said the woman in an exasperated tone. "You mean that honey ant is not your dreaming?"
Stan shook his head.
"Then what is your dreaming?"
The old man quivered like a schoolboy forced to betray a secret, and managed to wheeze the word,
"Emu."
"Oh, I am so confused."
The woman bit her lip in disappointment. She liked this soft-mouthed old man in his yellow shirt. She liked to think of the honey ants dreaming their way across the desert with the bright sun shining on their honey sacks. She had loved the painting. She wanted to own it, to have him sign it. And now she'd have to think again.
"Do you think,"
she mouthed her words slowly and carefully,
"that if we deposited the money with Mrs. Lacey," said Mrs. Lacey, "that you could paint us an emu dreaming and send it, have Mrs. Lacey send it to us in the United States?"
"No," Mrs. Lacey interrupted, "he could not. No artist paints his own dreaming. It's too powerful. It might kill him."
"Now I am totally confused," the woman wrung her hands. "You mean he can't paint his own dreaming, but he can paint somebody else's?"
"I get it," said the husband, brightening. "Like he can't eat emus, but he can eat honey ants."
"You've got it," Mrs. Lacey said. "Mr. Jacamara cannot paint an emu dreaming, because an emu is his paternal totem, and it would be sacrilege to do so. He can paint honey ants, because that is the totem of his mother's brother's son. That's right, isn't it, Stan? Gideon's dreaming is honey ant?"
Stan blinked and said,
"Right."
"Gideon," she continued, "is Stan's ritual manager. They both tell each other what they can and cannot paint."
"I think I understand,"
said the American woman doubtfully, but she still looked quite bewildered and took time to compose her next thought.
"You said that this Mr. Gideon is an artist too?"
"He is," Mrs. Lacey agreed.
"And he paints emu dreamings?"
"He does."
"Goody!"
The woman laughed unexpectedly and clapped her hands.
"We could buy one of each and hang them as a pair."
"Now, dearest," said the husband, in an effort to calm her, "first we have to ascertain if this honey ant painting is for sale, and if so, how much?"
Mrs. Lacey fluttered her eyelashes and said archly,
"I couldn't say. You'll have to ask the artist."
Stan rolled the whites of his eyes to the ceiling and rustled his lips. Obviously, he was thinking of a price. The price he'd get from Mrs. Lacey and doubling it. Obviously, he and Mrs. Lacey had been through this rigmarole before. He then lowered his head and said,
450.
Australian dollars, Mrs. Lacey chipped in. Of course, I'll have to charge my commission, 10%, that's only fair, and I'll have to add 20 for the paint and canvas.
Percent?
Dollars.
Fair enough,
said the man, looking rather relieved.
It is beautiful, the woman said.
Are you happy now?
He asked her in a soothing voice.
I am, she said. I am so happy.
Can I pay American Express?
He asked.
Surely, said Mrs. Lacey, as long as you don't mind paying their commission.
Fair enough, the man gulped. But now I want to know what's going on. In the painting, I mean.
Arkady and I crept up behind the Americans and watched old Stan point his bony finger at the large blue circle on the canvas. It was the eternal home, he explained, of the honey ant ancestor at Ta-Ta-Ta. And suddenly it was as though we could see the row on row of honey ants, their bodies striped and gleaming, bursting with nectar in their cells beneath the roots of the mulga tree. We saw the ring of flame-red earth around the entrance to their nest, and the roots of their migration as they spread to other places.
Circles, Mrs. Lacey added helpfully, are honey ant ceremonial centres. The tubes, as you call them, are dreaming tracks.
The American man was captivated.
And can we go and look for these dreaming tracks? Out there, I mean, like at Ayers Rock, someplace like that?
They can, she said. You can't.
You mean they're invisible?
To you, not to them.
Then where are they?
Everywhere, she said. For all I know, there's a dreaming track running right through the middle of my shop.
Spooky, the wife giggled.
And only they can see it?
Or sing it, Mrs. Lacey said. You can't have a track without a song.
And these tracks run every place?
The man asked.
All over Australia?
Yes, said Mrs. Lacey, sighing with satisfaction at having found a catchy phrase.
The song and the land are one.
Amazing, he said.
The American woman had pulled out her handkerchief and was dabbing the corners of her eyes. I thought for one moment she was going to kiss old Stan. She knew the painting was a thing done for white men, but he had given her a glimpse of something rare and strange, and for that she was very grateful. Mrs. Lacey readjusted her spectacles to fill out the American Express form. Arkady waved goodbye to Stan, and we heard the triumphant rumph of the machine as we went out onto the street.
What a woman, I said.
Some nerve, said Arkady. Come on, let's go and get a drink.